You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
Today on From Embers, we have an interview with Craig Fortier, who is an organizer and academic based in Toronto. Among other things, Craig is involved with No One Is Illegal and helps coordinate the Field of Dreamers Cooperative Softball Association, which was recently featured on an episode of Talking Radical Radio. Craig is the author of the short book Unsettling the Commons, Social Movements Within, Against, and Beyond Settler Colonialism, which was published in 2017 by Arbiter Ring. In it, Craig draws on more than 50 interviews with organizers within what he calls the anti-authoritarian current across Canada and the United States, and discusses what it means to struggle for the commons in the context of settler colonialism. He forcefully argues that a politics of unsettling and decolonization is foundational to the success of liberatory struggles in settler colonial states such as Canada. I reached him by phone in Toronto. We discuss the book, the ideas in it, how it informs his practice, and more.
So my name is Craig Forte. I'm currently working as an assistant professor at Renison University College, which is an affiliated college at the University of Waterloo. This book really came about from the intersection of doing a PhD dissertation at York and doing movement organizing and wanting to try to intentionally and thoughtfully work with other people in the movements I was a part of to get our ideas down and start to think about the ways in which particularly people organizing in urban centers were building relationships with Indigenous activists, whether that be in urban centers or land-based struggles.
And can you just tell us a bit about how the book sort of turned into a book, like as a project?
Yeah. So really it was, it came out of maybe about 2005 or 2006, and I was organizing as part of No One Is Illegal Toronto, which is a migrant justice organization in the city. And, you know, we had been having conversations with a formation that was building in the city called the Coalition in Support of Indigenous Sovereignty. And we decided it would be really important to have the coalition set up speaking events and engagements with various organizing groups in the city that included the Coalition Against Israeli Apartheid, included the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, No One Is Illegal, and to have these conversations about what it would really mean to tangibly organize in support of Indigenous sovereignty. It was a really profound moment for us in organizing, and it challenged a lot of the rhetoric that we had been using, the concepts that we had maybe borrowed from European No Borders movements, and made us confront the idea that organizing in a settler colonial state like Canada and the United States required that we had a different relationship with Indigenous communities. And that was really important and was really profound for me. It shifted the way that we were doing movement organizing within known as illegal. The work that we began to do, I think, particularly in 2006 in support of the reclamation at Six Nations, as well as work that was ongoing in Tandanega and other nations, surrounding nations, and eventually with Grassy Narrows. And so those relationships that were built made me really think through what it might mean for other organizations, other groups in different cities to develop those relationships as well. And so when I, you know, as we all are, when my precarious job in the city was coming to an end, I considered going to grad school. And I thought this would be a really important project, and worked on it for, I guess, the entirety of my PhD, which was about almost 7 years. And and so that it became my dissertation. But I really never wanted it to be like a academic work only. I wanted it to be something that would be returned to the movements where it came from and serve the movements in organizing. And so I was approached by folks at Arbiter Ring to make it into a small book for their Semaphore series. And I thought that was just the best possible outcome for me, because Semaphore was just something that was really easy and readable. And that's really what I wanted this particular book to be. And I really wanted the discussions and stories that came out of, you know, I interviewed, I think it was about 50 or 51 people in 9 different cities. So I really wanted those interviews to come out and the stories that they were sharing to come out as the primary thing that that I was working with.
And for our listeners, I'll say that I've read the book. It is a nice short book, which I personally really appreciate, because I almost never finish the books that I start. And it is very readable. Like, it's not, it doesn't come off as an academic jargony kind of piece. It is very, it's very easy to interact with, I found, at least.
I actually think it's such a challenge because, you know, this is a book of political theory to some degree. You know, it's not like a how-to book in terms of how to unsettle the commons per se, but it's political theory, I think, that is emerging from movements themselves and not from, you know, academia. And I think that's really important to highlight. And it was something that I really wanted to center in terms of how the book was written. And so it really flows from, you know, small little vignettes and stories that like try to center the reader in terms of my experience and what was going on while I was writing it, but also interspersed with the interviews themselves and the discussion as it was ongoing.
Yeah, and I noticed that there were a lot of interviews that informed the different issues that are explored in the book. And I think you mentioned in the book that you sort of focused on people that you considered in the anti-authoritarian current. I think that's the term that you used. And I've seen that in with Chris Dixon's stuff. And it seems to be a kind of, yeah, a category that has emerged as like a way of sort of cross-movement conversations. Do you have sort of any comments on what you consider to be the anti-authoritarian current?
Yeah, it's a good question. Chris Dixon was definitely a mentor for me when I was developing this project. I thought, you know, I was reading his book as I was developing my own plan of going out and doing research and trying to figure out who it was that I really wanted to talk to. And it really spoke to me, this generalness and vagueness of the anti-authoritarian current, but that it had a specificity to it and that we can kind of see it and understand it if we're involved in the movements we're involved in. And I think for me, it was an opportunity to speak about the ways in which anti-racist struggles, indigenous struggles, women of color struggles, so on and so forth, exists within anti-authoritarian spaces, yet don't want to be or don't feel the language of anarchism to fit what they're doing. That emerges, in fact, from long histories and traditions within their own cultures and struggles. And that's something that we need to affirm and recognize, that the multiplicity is really an important part of the learning and interconnection that we have as movements. And I think that just using the term anti-authoritarian current gives at least some kind of bound to the types of movements that we were interested in, both Chris and I, in terms of our research, right? So movements that weren't necessarily focused on, you know, electoral politics or, you know, fighting the government for more services, but were both movements of resistance and prefiguration.
And in terms of the audience that you had in mind for this book when you were writing it, who's the book written for, in your opinion?
For the most part, the book is written to be served back to the folks who contributed to it. So, you know, organizers within various currents of the anti-authoritarian movement, people who maybe are starting to get involved in organizing and feel often intimidated maybe to ask these type of questions in a bigger group, but want to do reading on their own. You know, folks, I think, who are at the fringes of our movements and maybe could be persuaded to shift towards our struggles and to, you know, increase the strength of our movements. And you know, obviously, I'm also interested, as somebody who's in the academy, I do see it as a space where we can proliferate these ideas to a mass public. And so ensuring that students and other academics are willing to read it and engage with the work is really important to me too, but especially the students. And that's, again, why I think like length is really important for me, and having shorter books that are more succinct and maybe don't go into as much depth as some of the other academic works I've read in my life, I think makes for an easier read for undergraduate students, for instance, or even high school students.
The context of the Occupy movement is seems to be a major sort of starting point for how the premise of the book starts to unfold. Were you involved with Occupy Toronto or around for Occupy Toronto, or were you more drawing on the debates and conversations out of Occupy Wall Street and Occupy/Decolonize Oakland?
Yeah. So actually, that's a really good question. And I would say that, like, so most of my research took place and most of my interviews took place between around 2011 to 2014. And so it was really at the height of both the emergence of Occupy as well as I Don't Know More, which I think were the two movements that really did inform and bring the discussions that were coming out of the book into sort of a more mainstream milieu. But I wasn't day-to-day involved with Occupy, but I was there for a number of days and ran workshops, and particularly through No One Is Illegal in Toronto. And but a lot of the people I interviewed for this research were either very closely connected or direct or sort of peripherally connected to various Occupy struggles. And it was, you know, really in that moment in terms of when I was doing the research, that was the potentiality of Occupy and its limitations were kind of laid bare in those years. And I think it was really interesting to be able to talk with people, you know, a couple years after it had occurred, about their experiences, about what really positively came out and sort of what issues that they foresaw coming out, particularly in Oakland, when folks really talked about that split that took place between Occupy Oakland and Decolonize Oakland. And many people had various interpretations in terms of why that split happened. But I think it was an important conversation to have in terms of the erasure, I think, oftentimes of indigenous struggles within upswings of radical movements. And it was funny that, you know, within months after Occupy sort of had its sort of crest, we saw the emergence of Idle No More, and that using, you know, a similar hashtag model to really spread from city to city.
Were these debates present in Toronto during the Occupy camp, and what did they look like? Like, what were the kind of terms of those discussions?
Yeah, I mean, I would say each camp, I think, was different. Each city was different, and I think it really depended on the context and that people were organizing in. And I would say that in Toronto itself, you know, I would say it had been about 4 or 5 years that some of the more active groups, like Known as Illegal or OCAP or the Coalition Against Israeli Apartheid, had really been trying to be more intentional about reimagining their struggles within a broader Indigenous sovereignty framework and what that might mean. And so a lot of those folks, particularly even folks who were coming out of the environmental justice movement, that conversation was already happening. And it had been messy in the mid-2000s, and I think a lot of real mistakes had been made, and folks were trying to learn from those mistakes. And so I think in Toronto, while, you know, there we saw similar maybe erasures that happened in New York or in Oakland or in other Occupy camps, I think there was an openness and a willingness to engage. And one of my favorite memories from the Occupy Toronto movement was when we held a march that essentially targeted the Hudson Bay Corporation at a time. It was a time where the whole rebranding and Hudson Bay blankets were really ongoing. And so there was an Occupy march that that was led by Indigenous people in our community, and that marched onto Hudson Bay to remind them about the history of those symbols. And so to some extent, I think that that conversation was happening in Toronto, and it's an ongoing conversation and an important one. And so, yeah, I would say it was a little bit different than what took place in Oakland or what took place in New York City, because the political terrain had shifted for us, at least.
In your book, you have a very interesting exploration of the history of Wall Street in Manhattan and sort of the colonial and pre-colonial history of Wall Street, and how it was, you know, historically actually a wall that was constructed to claim a settler commons over and against an indigenous commons that existed in that same area.
Yeah, the history of Manhattan is so interesting, and I was really moved to do some of that research from a letter written by Sandy Grande, who is a indigenous academic in New York State. And she had written one of those open letters to the Occupy Wall Street movement, where she had started to tell some of that story and that history of Occupy Wall Street and sort of where the idea of Wall Street came from. And for me, I think it was really important to talk about the ways in which we reinscribe meaning to things in the same area over and over and over again, and that we can wage struggle, you know, as the left in North America against the capitalist elite and erase that whole like history of continuously claiming the territories of the people on whose territories we're living on, right? And so I think that for me, that was really indicative of the gaps that Occupy Wall Street was showing in terms of its politics and its ability to understand the ways in which we were interconnected and for the most part sort of entwined in the ongoing occupation on Manhattan.
You use a term in your book about the crisis of legitimacy, I think is what you called it, that sort of left social movements face in settler colonial contexts. And you talk about how a lot of left social movements implicitly or explicitly rely on this idea of the creation of commons as the basis for like an anti-capitalist struggle. But in a settler colonial context, we face this crisis of legitimacy because of the colonial and genocidal histories that we're engaging in. Can you speak a bit to those ideas and how they sort of, how they unfold in your book?
For sure. I think the first thing that I wanted to just say is that, the commons is a really important idea, and it's not something that I think the book attempts to deny its importance, right? This notion that we wish to build societies in which we can all benefit from the resources and the experiences and the relationships that we have is a really important one. But I think oftentimes, like we do in a lot of, I think, Eurocentric social movements or ways of thinking, we tend to sort of see things as really homogenous. And so this idea of the commons can become really homogenized to this this like a reclamation of a particular time in European feudal history in which people shared land, agricultural land, and that while is important, is not the only form of commons, right? Just like the way in which we use anti-authoritarian movements, that while there may be affinity with anarchist movements, there may be some incommensurabilities between the way in which, say, indigenous anti-authoritarians and anarchist anti-authoritarians see particular relationships or ways of being and so on and so forth. And so the book really tries to push us, I think, to recognize those incommensurabilities, to recognize the multiplicity of commons, and then to be able to develop the relationships necessary to move through those incommensurabilities, right? And rather than to avoid them or to imagine them away or to simply just claim and erase what has and what continues to exist on these lands, which is the unceded sovereignty of many indigenous nations.
One point that you make in your book is about sort of shifting from ideas around occupation to ideas around decolonization. And decolonization is a word that has become somewhat of a trendy kind of word in academic or activist circles, but doesn't always have a lot of, in my experience, a lot of material substance to, or people lack an imagination around what that actually means. And I'm not asking you to fully spell out what decolonization is, but what kind of things are you gesturing towards in saying that?
Yeah, it's a challenge to speak to it because I think for the most part, I've been guided by various allied indigenous peoples who have multiplicities of ideas in terms of what decolonization might mean. And so really when we were getting to the point of naming the book, the idea of unsettling was really interesting to me as a responsibility of non-indigenous peoples on these territories, right? This idea that the word unsettling has that sort of double entendre, right? It has the idea of something feeling kind of, icky and makes you feel anxious and nervous, that unsettling feeling, but also this notion of the work that needs to be done to dismantle the structures of settler colonialism. And I think for me, that could, you know, that could involve occupation, right? But it would need to involve occupation that is in conversation with Indigenous peoples in struggle. And so I'm thinking here of, for instance, the work of some of the activists who were organizing around Line 9, who organized with the Indigenous folks in Amjanong, and, you know, occupied pipeline areas, you know, chained themselves to trucks and chained themselves to pipes and so on and so forth. And there's, you know, there's aspects of that sort of movement tactic occupy there. But the purpose and the intentionality is to do it in relation with the Indigenous communities on whose territories we share, right? And so I think for me that that's that whole unsettling aspect, right? Which is that it's vulnerable to take guidance and leadership. It's vulnerable to try to build relationships where you've had none prior to it. It's vulnerable when you don't know if you're going to make mistakes or you're going to do things that, you know, are offensive to people. But I think that is the work that needs to be done in order to really build our movements and make them stronger as we engage in this particularly nefarious era where capital and colonialism and white supremacy are really consolidated, right? And heteropatriarchy and so on and so forth.
So in the case of No One Is Legal, there's some discussion of that in the book as well in terms of, you know, the rhetoric of No One Is Legal is about freedom to move, freedom to stay, freedom to return. And it has like a strong anti-border perspective, which I'm 100% behind. And then, given that these movements are happening in a settler colonial context and that there's a desire to relate and respect Indigenous sovereignty, I imagine that's a challenging thing to bring those two things into conversation without just reifying notions of statehood and just applying it to Indigenous people. And there's a nice effort in the book to sort of redefine these questions of boundaries, not in this status idea around borders, but as sort of like relations. Can you speak a bit to that?
Yeah, for sure. And so I definitely want to give credit to Harsha Walia in Vancouver Coast Salish territories, who is an organizer at No One Is Illegal there, and who had a really profound impact on myself and many people, I think, in Toronto in terms of thinking these things through. And for her, I think that comes from really deep, intimate relationships that she's developed of building a discussion and a dialogue and care with a number of the Coast Salish and other Indigenous nations in British Columbia. And I think that really rings true in a number of ways, not just in terms of building relationships between Indigenous and non-Indigenous, but this notion of moving towards an understanding of the spaces we occupy as having boundaries that need to be negotiated through relationship and consent and conversation and discourse and dialogue. And, you know, we do this in our movements in terms of how we interact, in terms of intimate relationships. We should be doing this in terms of how we play with each other, how we organize with each other. But I think also we need to think about it in terms of the ways in which people have organized historically to designate and signify space, right? And I think it's important to understand that, you know, for us here in Toronto, that the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee and Huron-Wendat peoples have had long relationships with these lands and these territories. They've tended these relationships. They've tended to the various plants and waters and so on and so forth. And that is a really, we're being invited to engage in those relationships in a good way as well. You know, we're not being excluded from that. And I think that's a really important thing to move forward with. And if that requires us to follow protocols that respect those relationships, I think that is a much more viable way to both recognize the types of sovereignties that Indigenous peoples claim on the land, and to also fight the nation-state borders and Westphalian sovereignty that claims territory to turn it into property to be sold. And I don't necessarily think they are as contradictory to each other as I think many people have tried to make them. And so you see this in the work of many of the Indigenous communities who have opened their lands up and their communities up to refugees when the Canadian state has refused them, who have worked to help people cross borders when the Canadian state has claimed their nation, which crosses both maybe a Canada-US or US-Mexico border. And I think that's a really important guidance that is being offered to us.
Land of dreams, come and pay, free, 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 raise your families, promises, 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 drive your taxis, work your jobs, no protection, money is gas. Promises, 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 promises. Go back to where you belong. But tell me, where could that be if this is where I was born? Go back to where you belong. But tell me, where could that be if this is where I am from?
Listening to From Embers, a regular show of anarchist ideas and practice based in Kingston. This is an interview that we did with Craig Fortier, who is the author of the book Unsettling the Commons: Social Movements Within, Against, and Beyond Settler Colonialism. If you want to pick up a copy, you can get it through Arbiter Ring, your local library, or AK Press. Sort of being a part of some of the same kind of movements and discussions over the years, a lot of those discussions in terms of Indigenous solidarity and centering Indigenous sovereignty in our practices, when it goes into the nitty-gritty level, oftentimes it's about how Indigenous communities are not homogenous. There's always multiple voices coming from particular communities. And how do you navigate sort of all of those dynamics that are internal to those communities in a way that's respectful and also true to yourself? Do you have any sort of comments or thoughts about those challenges?
Sure. I think it's both a challenge for non-Indigenous folks, but it's also a challenge for Indigenous folks, right? They are also trying to fight these structures of power like settler colonialism and capitalism and so on and so forth, and they have to look out in the sea of non-Indigenous folks who everyone wants to be their ally. But, you know, as we learn, you know, people like Justin Trudeau may talk a good game, but are really invested in the expansion of capital. But also, you know, a number of us in our groups, because of ego or because of a non-understanding, you know, we want those communities to do the work of our movements without really building that relationality and care. And so to me, it really comes back down to who do you have relationship with? Who are you willing to make relationship with? You know, what kind of relationship do you foresee? And that relationship doesn't mean that you're always going to be 100% politically aligned on every single issue. That doesn't happen within our social group movement groups. Even the most small affinity groups of a few people have disagreements in terms of what their fundamental goals are in certain things, right? And so I think the idea is can you build the relationships that are caring enough and trusting enough that even when you disagree, you can trust that you're still working together, right? And you're still building together. And for me, that is fundamental to this process that's being offered to non-Indigenous radicals, is that we're being offered relationships, and some of us are trying to take them up, and I think some of us are wanting to sort of bring those relationships back into the kind of utilitarian model that we often use, which is like, how do we win this small campaign in front of us without thinking about the big picture of what type of world we want to create? And I think that world for me is a world in which when we have disagreements, when we have falling outs, that we're able to work through them.
Yeah, I'm kind of reminded a bit of some of the stuff that was being put out by the Native Youth Movement years ago around their rejection of the BC treaty process. And some of what they were talking about was this anxiety on the part of settler communities to have this kind of final answer, final solution to the Indian problem, so-called, and how that always pushes things towards, like you said, these utilitarian relationships or these programs of assimilation through the state, and centering relationships as opposed to kind of blueprints or final answers or something like that. I think is a nice way to think about unsettling, and also, I kind of agree that that's got to be the compass moving forward, as opposed to like how are we all going to live together? Who's going to live where? What is going to be our international protocols? Like, those things are good to think about, but to some extent, we have to give up control over the answers of those things and enter into relationships with a more open mind than that.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's really at the crux of it, is that like, we have to be able to put ourselves in positions where we're uncomfortable, that we're vulnerable, that we're unsettled, right? And that's a really, I think, maybe that's a very common thing amongst like white Western folks, but like, this idea that's very troubling for people. Like, people don't want to move, and like, they'd rather people be in really dire, awful circumstances than feel uncomfortable. And, you know, I've noticed that, you know, I was on strike when I was at York University, and even, you know, going to talk to people who were being delayed for 10, 15, 20 minutes in their cars as they went through the picket lines, you know, people were more angry about being delayed for 10 or 15 minutes than they were angry about the conditions in which we were working, right? And they would say, you know, I understand why you're doing this, but I don't agree with why you're delaying me. And I think that on a bigger level is really fundamental. You know, I've had so many conversations with friends and family who are like, well, I understand the need for indigenous sovereignty, but how else are we going to get the oil from one place to another, right? And I think that that's, you know, people are like, well, are you willing to give up this and that? And I think the reality is we have to be willing to at least reimagine the societies we want to live in. And a lot of that reimagining will require moments and periods of discomfort and unknowing and vulnerability. And I think if we work in good relation with each other, it won't require as much pain and hardship and death that this current system works on. Fear, death, pain, hardship, right?
You know, another dynamic at play that I think of is like a lot of what we do, at least here as anarchists, is we are trying to encourage people to build up their confidence to some extent as well. So we want to build up people's confidence so that they're willing to, you know, risk things to themselves, so that they're willing to stand up for what they believe in, so that they're willing to act when it seems like the odds are against you. And I don't think that has to come into conflict with the discomfort of unsettling, or especially I like the word vulnerability that comes with unsettling. But what do you think about this idea that we also need to build up people's confidence, and how does that interact with the less productive kind of white guilt version of unsettling?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if we think about it, you know, I remember watching this, it was a show on TV or something, which basically the show was asking people, you know, if your dog or your somebody who you love or your best friend was taken and you had to do something about it, you would do it, right? Like, you'd have that confidence. But if somebody who you're not connected with, it happens to them, you may act somewhat, but you're maybe less likely to feel that need to act, right? And I think that really comes from the fact that in our society, we are isolated. You know, capitalism creates a situation which we are isolated, alienated from, not only from our labor, but from everybody in our community, even sometimes our own families and friends, right? That we don't feel connected. And that means that we're afraid, if things happen, to do things. And so I don't think they're, you know, I think being vulnerable to the point where you're allowing yourself to come into relation with people and to recognize that relationship isn't always going to be, you know, even flow and great and a honeymoon, but it's going to have its ups and downs, and you're going to make mistakes, and you're going to have to be humble and learn from those mistakes. But that's what I think gives us confidence to fight for each other, right? And that's the confidence that I think we want to build, not the ego confidence, but the confidence of relationality, that we're interdependent upon each other and that we're willing to be vulnerable with each other in the face of, you know, states that have far more military and, you know, physical power than we do. But I think our strength has always been in our relationality and our ability to connect with people at a mass scale.
Can you speak a bit about the Ashkamadzig Unity Camp and the impact it had on you?
Yeah, I think Ashkamadzig was a really interesting moment because, you know, it emerged and disappeared in the length of the writing of the dissertation. But I think it actually serves well, because the relationships that were formed from Ashkamadzig have really sustained me, like, beyond the camp itself. And so, to give a little context, a friend of mine, Gibwanase, and another friend of his, Johnny, were two people who were offered as part of a settlement up near Christian Island, Penetanguishene in Midland, Ontario. There was a settlement on their reservation, essentially one of the Canadian government's termination settlements, where the people would give up their claims to the land for a cash payout for each member of the nation. And they wanted to refuse that payout and to assert sovereignty on the land. And so they started up a camp in Owenda Provincial Park, which is just outside of Penetanguishene in Midland. It's actually really interestingly was one of the places where a treaty was signed between early English settlers and the community, the Anishinaabe community in that area. And so they showed us the Council Rock where that signature was sort of carved in the stone on the rock. And we went up there as part of our union, the QP 3903, First Nations Solidarity Working Group, to just help build some structures, because the plan was for them to have the camp over the winter, to have people come, be able from all the different nations. Ashkamadzeg is a word that derives from the seven grandfather teachings, or the prophecies, and the lighting of the eighth fire, which is where this prophecy, as it was told to us, came from, would bring about what are called the new people, the Ashkamadzeg. And so we were invited as supporters of this group of folks to come up and help build structures and so on and so forth. And I think it was a really important moment for us to actually just take guidance and leadership, and to kind of have some of the discussions I think people were having in Occupy camps, but to have them in a way that was rooted in the knowledges that were the indigenous and Anishinaabe knowledges that were guiding the people who set up the camp in the first place. And so I think for me, that's a really important thing, is that it really centered this relationality, and it really had a profound impact on what I brought back to organizing in the various spaces that I continue to organize with today.
Do you have any thoughts on sort of, every place is different, but some of the differences between how this plays out in urban spaces compared to how it plays out in rural spaces, say in a land defense or reclamation situation, as opposed to urban social movements like Idle No More?
Yeah, I think that's really, it's a really important question, because there's a tendency amongst folks in the radical left to fetishize land-based struggle, right? To think of land-based struggle as this originary indigenous struggle. And I think it had a racist, very much a racist, the fact that urban indigenous struggle is just as originary. It is just as vital, right? It is people who are protecting these places. And here in Toronto, for instance, the work of No More Silences, it is a Native Youth Sexual Health Network, and I Don't Know More, and the various formations that it takes are still engaged in that work. It's just a work that is different from the particular context of land-based struggle, right? And at times it is land-based struggle. We had the really important project that took place, I guess it would have been about 3 years or 4 years ago now, the Ogima Mekana project, where activists were changing the street signs of Toronto to reflect Anishinaabe names for the spaces. And I think that is a really important intervention that requires engagement from folks in major cities, non-Indigenous folks in major cities, to observe, to affirm, and to build relationships with. And so for me, that's always been important. You know, the fact that groups like the Native Youth Sexual Health Network and No More Silence have continued to build and mobilize around missing and murdered Indigenous women and trans folks and Two-Spirit peoples, as well as the way in which I Don't Know More has really responded to major events in this city over the last few years, whether it be the acquittal of the person who murdered Colton Bushi or Tina Fontaine, and most recently with the federal government's violation of Wet'suwet'en sovereignty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sometimes we forget that cities are also made up of land, and the dichotomy can fall apart sometimes for us as well.
Totally, yeah.
What do you think those of us who are not indigenous engaging in these social movements, what do you think are most immediate weaknesses with respect to centering indigenous sovereignty? And yeah, what do you think is sort of like the immediate priority that we should be discussing in terms of improving our practices?
You know, I'm probably going to start to sound like a broken record, but I do think it's this idea of actually building relationships, right? And when you have relationships, you will center things because they're central to your life. And when you have, you know, you're not going to forget to do things. You're not going to put it aside. You're not going to erase. You're not going to make it seem less important if your relationships are central. And we know this just from the fact that that's how we operate as humans, right? Is that we give precedence to the relationships that matter most to us. And I think that that's an important work that needs to be done for activists, particularly non-Indigenous activists, but also, you know, obviously important for Indigenous folks as well, is to connect with each other, to build those relationships, to listen, right? I think sometimes we want to tell everything that we're doing and show off all the good things we want to do, but I think it's also important just to listen. And sometimes that listening might involve being uncomfortable because people have anger and frustration built up that they need to get out. And sometimes you're the receiver of that that anger and frustration, even if maybe you didn't directly contribute to it. You know what I'm saying? So I think that that's really important, and that just means, you know, similar to what you were talking about in my experience, I mean, sometimes showing up uninvited or, you know, being asked for allies and just showing up and not knowing what you can do, but being committed and humble and willing to take direction, but also willing to take action and leadership, right? And I think sometimes when social movements groups are in the process of building those relationships, they wish to do everything by checking back in with whoever they believe they're in allyship with, right? And I think that's actually kind of problematic in and of itself, right? Because you should be able to make those decisions and choices and do that work as long as you're communicating and making sure that you're taking direction that doesn't impede on the work that is ongoing by the people you're trying to support, right? And so that's something I very much learned from folks in Montreal who I think model that in a very good way in groups like No One Is Illegal, but other groups in the city.
I mean, for you, do those relationships mostly look like informal relationships, or do they look like sort of organization to organization relationships with processes in place and that kind of thing?
You know, I think we probably need both. We definitely need, like, one thing I think that I've seen in my work that I think it can be really tough is when one person holds a number of relationships and no one else in the group does, because then what happens is that puts a lot of pressure and power and responsibility on that one person to sort of be an intermediary. And I think that creates significant problem. And I recognize that, you know, it takes a long time for people to develop the type of trust that usually comes with having that place, but finding ways to spread your relationships to make sure that not one person in a particular group is forming relationships with other groups or other communities or leaders from other spaces is really important, because in the end we want to make sure that relationality is felt across the board for each other, right? And so I think maybe answering your question means actually saying that both are important for different purposes.
Mm-hmm. Are there any ideas or concepts or stories that we didn't get to that you want to talk about?
I guess the only thing that maybe kind of speaks to the way in which this process and doing this research really affected me personally is that I started to see the way in which even in the most mundane parts of our lives, we could really start to try and shift the way we do things. And so a really good example is that for years, folks in No One Is Legal and other sort of social movement groups in Toronto have been playing, we've been playing in sort of just one of those mainstream corporate baseball leagues, rec softball leagues, as a team called The Uncertainty. And we started to really have conversations about the fact that, you know, we're provocative and like weird in terms of how people like read us in those mainstream leagues, but we hadn't been doing a lot of that relational work. And so we formed our own league called Field of Dreamers back in 2017. And it's really had this big impact because it's not just, you know, it's not just like we're playing baseball or softball together or whatever, but it's actually, you know, it's people organizing in a whole bunch of things in the city and actually starting to build really deep relationships because we see each other every week. It's a no-pressure situation. We're building each other's skill sets. We're modeling things that we want to do. But we're also doing that same work that we've been talking about, which is acknowledging that, you know, we play at Trinity Bellwoods Park. Trinity Bellwoods has a long contested history in terms of white settlers occupying that land that was for a long time like a Seneca space that was lived in and that was used for agriculture, and it was on the banks of what we now call Garrison Creek, which is buried underneath the park. And so having those conversations and really bringing those into, you know, we do opening ceremonies where we take leadership from the Indigenous folks in the group in terms of how to thank the land properly and how to do that work. And so despite the fact that it's play, it's also been an important part of really building that relationality into that aspect of my life as well. And so for me, it's like that's been a really important takeaway, that we can't just have movement spaces like focused on the political task. We have to have movement spaces that focus on modeling the sociality and relationships that we wish to create, because it's actually really hard. It's actually really hard to build those relationships. It's not just a simple thing of like, oh, we got to build relationships. It's actually really hard to build relationships that aren't invested in the same logics of capital and utilitarianism and misogyny and patriarchy that run through our social lives.
Are there other kind of books or texts or other kinds of projects that you want to shout out and encourage people to check out to explore these ideas more fully?
Yeah, for sure. Folks should read Harsha Walia's Undoing Border Imperialism. It's one of my favorite books of all time. I think it speaks to a lot of the themes that are in my book, but probably way better. And I would say, really, for me, Glenn Coulthard's Red Skin, White Mask has been really eye-opening. It's a more challenging read, but still worthwhile in terms of thinking through the limits in our current era of recognition and reconciliation as things that basically like white people are pushing out there as being the solution to the quote-unquote Indigenous problem sort of thing. I would say if I gave a third book, I really, really did appreciate reading Audra Simpson's Mohawk Interruptus, and it spoke to this notion of, you know, her home community, which is a community that is split by the Canada-US border, and talking about living life across that border and boundary despite that border and boundary existing. And so for me, I think those are three books that really inspire me.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and encourage everyone to check out your book. If you're in Kingston, I ordered it to the library, so you can get it out of the Kingston Public Library. Otherwise, how do you get the book?
You can get it from Arbiter Ring. And if you're in the United States, you can get it from AK Press. I think it retails for, it's under $15. So it's not super expensive, but you can, I think you can also get it in a number of different libraries across Ontario. So if you're not in the Kingston area, you should be able to check it out there. And hopefully we can get it into as many hands for as little cost as possible.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah. Recording live from Occupied Turtle Island. Test their logic. No nations. No borders. Both law and order. Yeah. No one is illegal. We're all people. We're all equal. No borders. No fences. No nations. No prisons. No deportations. No one is illegal. We're all people. We're all equal. No borders. No fences. No nations. No prisons. No deportations.
You should know it's a racist state. A colonized genocidal corporate cage. Only the privileged get through the gate. And their so-called freedom is built by slaves. We're the black sheep and the ghosts they scape. The targets of anti-migrant hate. Stop complaining about the jobs they take. No living wage, exploited and underpaid. To work the fields, to put food on your plates. Economic prisons, we're the inmates. Scattered peoples, we are displaced. Now we can't get caught, do whatever it takes. Let's organize, mobilize and make a jailbreak. It's time to ride, freedom can't wait. Human fate, moving the proletariat like the late great Tubman, Harriet, property and law. We're breaking it, got no patience left for this racist ish. Break through the borders, disobey orders, evade police forces. Light up the torches, fire by night, water by day. Follow stars and suns, find your way to greener pastures and try to stay. Give love and respect to the lands and ways of the peoples who was there before you came. Before imperialism brought all this pain. Decolonize the land, decolonize your brain. And stop acting like a settler, that shit is lame.
No one is illegal, we're all people, we're all equal. No borders, no fences, no nations, no prisons, no deportations. No one is illegal, we're all people, we're all equal. No borders, no fences, no nations, no prisons, no deportations. Who's illegal? Who's indigenous? Talk about immigrants, are Europeans serious? The government instrument is stolen land, insidious. Borders and orders and children are in prison and face it. This is a racist state, built on genocide, apartheid and hate. Colonized native peoples and the land was raped. Now the white boys are the ones guarding the gate. Give me a break, they take and take, pay less than minimum wage. How you supposed to keep food on the plate? You got three jobs and always on the alarm. Are shipped in the pick all the food for them on the farms. The communities at home, the land was robbed by these capitalist bastards, international mob. What choice do you have when your family starve? But make the trek to the north, to Babylon. See, the city is a sweatshop, you gotta be strong. No rights or status, exploited and harmed. Working under the table without any papers. The system's maintained by the stolen labor. This trade arrangement, wage enslavement, diaspora on the pavement. Searching for payment, but to pay rent is where most your time went. All the money spent, what's left, barely a dime or a cent. Face it, the system is racist, the basis is classes. Most of the poor have brown faces. Fact is, classes tied to what race is. A perception twisted into what hate is. I can't take it, see no one is illegal. We're all equal, the system is evil. So shake these nations and break the borders. Reunite families and stop the poor and no one is illegal, we're all people, we're all equal. No borders, no fences, no nations, no prisons, no deportations. No one is illegal, we're all people, we're all equal. No borders, no fences, no nations, no prisons, no deportations.
listening to Dissident Island Radio.
Live every first and third Friday of the month at 9 p.m. GMT.
Check out www.dissidentisland.org for downloads and more.